This is Mireya Loza. It's the 28th of July, 2008. I'm here with Paul Levine, L-A-V-I-N-E, Levine, in Salem, Oregon.
Mr. Levine, can you tell me where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Los Angeles, California, on September 9th, 1923.
And your parents?
My parents were both from immigrants. My mother was born in Basel, Switzerland, and my father in Kiev, and spent a good part of his time in Odessa and before coming to the United States. So I have a feeling for people who have immigrated here. I'm a second generation and know about those things. Go ahead.
What are your parents working?
My dad was a metallurgist. My mother just took care of the home. She was a homemaker. And my father, I don't know about his education, but he was educated to the point that he could read and write in four different languages and spoke perhaps six languages. And my mother was an interesting thing. She was 12 years old when the San Francisco earthquake occurred where she lived. And if you've ever been in an earthquake, you never forget it. So she had some colorful stories to tell about it. The family was taken to across the bay to a little town called Emeryville. And my mother, she was a large family. She was the oldest child. And she had to go back with a large baby carriage and go through the militia and sneak through and get baby diapers and food and stuff and bring it back to her family. So that's quite a story.
They both lived in Los Angeles after you were born?
Yes, my mother grew up in the San Francisco area and right amongst mostly Italians, and so she was one of the best Italian cooks that you'd ever want to meet. My dad, when he immigrated from Russia, went through Manchuria and through Japan and down to Lima, Peru, and then from Lima, Peru to Argentina and then to Chicago, or through Ellis Island and then to the Bay Area and eventually to Los Angeles. So he had a colorful journey also.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, it's a big family. My mother and dad both had children when they married the second time, so there was his and hers and ours. And in the immediate family, there was five boys and one girl. And then I had brothers and sisters that were half brothers and sisters.
And were you of the oldest or of the youngest?
I was right in the middle.
What was it like growing up in Los Angeles?
It's hard to explain. If you've been in Los Angeles now and know how crowded it is, and when I was a kid in Los Angeles, Los Angeles was still a sleeping, it was a little village actually. There was downtown Los Angeles, and then in between it was just fields. agricultural fields and jackrabbits running around. There were still the original adobe houses that were there as when Los Angeles was growing, and I used to brag that I could go any place in Los Angeles blindfolded, and within 3 minutes I'd know where I was at. I would no longer make that claim when they put the freeways crisscrossing across Los Angeles. I'm lost down there now. And the whole complexion changed. There were a lot of Mexican people living there, but they didn't call themselves. One of my sister-in-laws was Mexican descent, but she bristled at that at being called Mexican because she was a Californio. You know, when California originally was part of Mexico, and there was always, when I was a kid, there was always the flavor of Mexico in Los Angeles and San Diego, and of course the missions which I visited most of them, the 21 missions spreading from San Diego up to the San Francisco. And going to school there, they had the huge Long Beach earthquake when I was 10 years old. And the school that I went to was not destroyed, but made unsafe, and so they moved tents onto the school grounds. And for all of the rest of my grammar school, I went to school in a tent. And I can remember, you know, if a tent gets nice and warm, and I would sleep through lots of it because it's nice and warm in the classroom. Then when I went to high school, we had no middle school, so I went directly to high school. You had a little seventh grader running around with all these seniors. It was kind of a big thing. So we would go places as a boy. Into places that were wilderness and are now solid with homes and so on. I rode horseback where Disneyland is now, and the Los Angeles River, which is now a concrete ditch, was a wild river. Didn't have a lot of water in it except during rainy periods. But as kids spent hours and hours down there, it was a wilderness. And of course the Big Depression was on, and all along the river there were places where they called them hobos. Actually they were homeless. They were people that were out of work and lived down in the they would put their little places up in there, and they were quite elaborate with back in the trees. They were not large trees, large shrubs, I would guess. But they would, and us kids could ride our bicycles there, ride horseback through the river, and to see it now, just all concrete. Streets, like we would go, we lived 7 miles from the ocean and 7 miles from the Rose Parade. We would ride to the Rose Parade on our bicycles, or we'd ride to the beach on our bicycles, or hitchhike. In those days, it was hitchhiking was a way for young people to get around. My buddies and I would get out on the main street and hitchhike in one direction, and if we didn't get a ride, we'd cross the street, hitchhike in the opposite direction, just to be doing something. And we spent a lot of time at the ocean, I learned to swim in the ocean and had some real adventures there. Almost got drowned a few times when there was a terrific surf running, probably 13 years old, sitting on top of a 20-foot wave and looking down is you wonder, what am I doing up here? So it was quite an experience and a neat place to grow up, I wouldn't want to raise kids in Los Angeles now. It's entirely different. Although, it's what you make of it. Kids come growing down there now are still pretty good kids, but they certainly don't have the experiences that I did. So as we go along, I was a high school dropout, and I went into the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, that was started in 1931 by President Roosevelt. Within 30 days of him becoming president, they had the CCCs started. And the whole idea was to take young people off the streets. There were no jobs. There was a major depression. And take young kids off the street and put them into building parks and planting trees and building flood control, soil erosion control, so they offered a night school while I was there, so I got my diploma while I was in the CCCs, I was first sergeant most of the time I was in, which was quite a thing for a young man with 200 people in each camp, and I was in charge of 200 people. And I have a lot of stories about that. Incidentally, I'm writing a book about my life, and the CCCs was an important part of it. Then, while I was in the CCCs, the war was declared on Japan and Germany after Pearl Harbor, and I immediately, sometime that was, I didn't join up until 1942, November of 1942, I went into the Navy. And saw action in invasion of Guam and at Guadalcanal, and my ship was sunk by a kamikaze at Okinawa, and I was wounded, and then came back to the States and was stationed on the East Coast for the rest of my Navy career until they kicked us all out. They said there's, and so I came home and took advantage of the GI Bill, which was one of the greatest things this country has ever done they call us the greatest generation, and it was because of the opportunity to go to school. I had plans towards going to college, but I don't know if I could have ever have afforded it, and that was a new experience for me. A friend of mine had been had gone to motor machinist school at New Mexico State University, so he said, "Let's go there." And one of the things he told me was that there was three girls for every guy, and I thought that was great. Of course, when we got there, all the GIs going back to school, there was 13 guys for every girl, And so it's that's where I met my wife, and we have a little family story that I married her so I could have a date once in a while. And we got married, and before I got my bachelor's degree, we had our first daughter. And then I was awarded a teaching assistantship at Oklahoma State University, and I went there and helped teach Horticulture 101 and worked towards my degree, and almost got my doctor's degree, but by that time we had two children and going to school, even though I had the assistantship, we just couldn't afford it. So then I was my first job out of school, I was a horticulturist at Alcalde, New Mexico, which was a high altitude experiment station. And I was telling you earlier, I was the only Anglo, and that was there's something to ponder. You didn't say Mexican, because they were a lot of the guys that I worked with, or a lot of the people in Alcalde were descendants of the earliest Spaniards in New Mexico, and they claimed to be Spanish. So rather than saying Anglo or Mexican, you said Spanish speaking or Anglo, and people understood that, and there was no argument about it. But it was a great experience for me to be there as a horticulturist. The experiment station was just started, so I was the first horticulturist there, and the aim of the experiment station was to find crops that could be grown locally, and I would say that probably 75% of the people that lived in the area were Hispanic, and so I was steeped in the culture. That was in 1952. And in 1952, they were at that in northern New Mexico. They were still practicing barter for the guy that grew wheat would barter it for chili, and the guy with chili would trade it for wool, and the mattresses were made stuffed with wool. It was quite an experience. Even the wheat. When they would take it up on a hill when the wind was blowing, and toss the wheat into the air and to winnow it and up to knock forget the name of it, but the wheat would fall down and the chaff would fly into the wind, and that was really primitive, but it was an interesting part of my life. Later, when I got in, when I went to work for the University of California as a farm advisor, farm advisors are known as county agents in the rest of the United States. California chose to call them farm advisors, and I developed a specialty in grapes and all of the small fruits, which included all kinds of berries, strawberries and caneberries. And some of the stuff that I learned that was very primitive in New Mexico could be applied to small farms in California. It would just fit right in with small machinery or no machinery. All of our stuff at Alcalde a big part of it was done with a horse horse driven. The guys all knew how to handle horses. We grew potatoes. The potatoes were plowed out with a horse or a small tractor, and that was really primitive compared to California, where they were highly mechanized. So in California, I saw the first tomato pickers developed. California was about to lose the tomato industry because the lack of laborers to pick them and to pick the tomatoes, through the University of California and some private developers, they developed a tomato picker, and so that rather than losing the tomato industry, it grew now to where it's just a big industry with the tomatoes being picked by machine, and the crews are well paid. They go from one field to the next, and it requires skills that the ordinary picker, somebody that was field picking, had to develop these skills, and they were paid well for it. So,
why was there a lack of labor in terms of tomato picking?
There just wasn't enough people coming in to pick the tomatoes at that time. They depended on the Bracero program, which wasn't large enough to cover the tremendous acreage of tomatoes, and then tomatoes conflicted with peach harvest and grape harvest, so at that time, as important as the Bracero program was a migrant labor program. People would migrate in, and they would proselytize in Texas and New Mexico and Oklahoma, and people were encouraged to come out, and they would come out, and they would follow the crops. They would start in one area in California, and then they would move up into Oregon and into Washington, and they were known as migrant workers. They had housing, limited housing for them, and it sounds like a tough thing, and I don't know if any of them got rich, but they enjoyed the life. They were, I guess you would call them, modern day nomads, and the whole family would work together, and so it was not unusual for a family to earn $1,000 or $1,500 in a week, which at that time was big money. And when you would tell people, well, there were, at that time they were starting the movement towards it was sounding like the poor farm workers were being beat down and everything, and we had one incident where go ahead. Kids from Berkeley were protesting the life of the farm worker, and so our assemblyman Claire Berryhill made arrangements to bring two busloads of kids down from Berkeley, students at Berkeley, and bring them down, and I got involved in it. We called farmers all around the area. Can you put up a couple of kids for the night? And so the kids were housed down there, and then Then they put him on the bus, and I was on one of the buses, and I told the kids, now you're in charge. You just tell the bus driver which way to go, and if you see somebody working in the field and you want to stop and talk to him, tell the bus driver and he'll stop there. I said, you are not being told where to go or what to do. That it was really an eye-opener for these kids to go out in the field and talk to workers and find that they were happy and that they enjoyed the work. We made a lot of believers out of them. And then they met that evening. We had a dinner for them, there were other legislators, and our congressman was there, the kids wrote of their experience, and years later they were still friends with their host farmers that hosted them, and it was a good experience. I was involved closely in the harvesting and so on, I bought a vineyard. We bought a vineyard, and because we wanted to give our kids, by that time we had five children, and we wanted to give them work ethic and have a place for them to work. Frankly, I hired people that were in the country illegally, because I had to get the grapes picked, and I didn't do the hiring. That was the way the farmers got around it. You hired a contractor who hired the workers, and so you were able to kind of bend the law about hiring illegals. When the vineyard was picked, we'd always furnish beer to everybody, and it was a happy thing. They enjoyed working, and I enjoyed having them. It was always interesting when I was making out the checks, that sometimes there would be six or eight checks all with the same Social Security number. And somebody got a lot of money in their Social Security account, and these other guys, it was just an attempt to be legal. I don't know where, I'm kind of rambling, but...
At this point, did you hire braceros, and in what year did you...
I just only had 15 acres. The braceros were mostly at the larger farms, and I knew that the braceros were there. I would visit some of the farms, and on occasion they would have me in for lunch to show me what kind of food. Not that I was in a position to say, well, this is good or bad or anything, but they did it because they were proud of the food that they were getting. And the whole Bracero program really got a bad name with the 60-minute program, Harvest of Shame, which was really a distortion of the whole picture. One of the things I learned in psychology is if something hurt you, it was just a human response to not go back and be hurt the second time. And I used to tell that story because here were the same, I would see the same people at these farms year after year. So if they were being mistreated, why did they go back there? But at St. Mary's University, during the height of the Cesar Chavez thing, they they voted to not serve grapes on the campus, and a young lady there whose father had a vineyard in Modesto called her dad and says, "Dad, can't you do something about it?" So he called a number of people that and asked them if they would go over to the university and debate with a group from people who thought that the university would be better by not serving grapes, that it would serve the cause. So, working for the University of California, I couldn't get up. But then one of the people didn't show up, so the priest that was in charge of it said, "We need another debater." And I said, "Well, don't tell anybody, but I'll get up there." So a story I told, and I think it really illustrates before the. And there was about 500 people in the auditorium, and interesting. And I pointed to one girl, and I said, "This girl over here makes all of her own clothes. And this girl over here can bake the best angel food cake you've ever eaten. But this girl over here, she's been going down to what you might call Lover's Lane, and maybe she was just petting, maybe she was necking, maybe she went all the way. Who cared about the girls that could make their dresses and do the cake? Nobody. But the girl who was doing something wrong, everybody on campus said, "Hey, that girl's no good." And that's the way it is with the farmers. There were some guys, and I knew a couple of them that were real jerks. I mean, they were real jerks. They I don't know whether it was braceros, but it was farm workers, and at this one big strawberry field, I was out there. The workers had walked off the job, and I don't know how I got involved, because I was not a labor person. I was a teacher. I was to bring the scientific things from the university down to the farmers. But at any rate, the guy called me and he says, "My strawberries are rotting." And he says, "These guys, what he says, "Who do you know?" And I says, "Well, why'd they walk off?" And he says, "Shit." He says, I fed them lunch. And I said, "What'd you serve them?" And he says, "Well, bologna and bologna sandwiches." I said, "These people don't want bologna sandwiches. They want burritos for lunch." And I said, so there was that guy. There was one that I knew, and he was a foreigner himself, had citizenship here, but he was an Iranian or Persian, and they picked his grapes, and then he told them that. Is get out of here, or I'm going to call the Border Patrol. Well, what a clown, you know, to do something like that. And then another time, I was just driving down the road, coming from out in the field towards my office, and I was hailed by a group of people on the side of the street, and I guess they recognized the car had a decal on it for University of California, and they thought that maybe they had picked the guy's carrots, and when it came time to get paid, there was nobody around, and they said, "Do something." I said, "Well, I can't do anything." I said, "I don't have that power." I said, "But so when I got in, I called the sheriff, and the sheriff couldn't do anything about it." These incidents happened, and it's like the old saying, one bad apple ruins a barrel, you know. In any work, There's good teachers and there's bad teachers. There's good bankers, there are bad bankers, there's good real estate. There were good people to work with and really neat and really looked out for the people that worked for them. And I know that we were the leading county for boysenberries, and there was a couple of years when the price of the berries was so low that the farmers were wiped out, but they still paid their pickers. The pickers made more money than the farmer did. It was one of those things. And as far as the Bracero program, I felt that it was really successful. It had its inception in back in 1942 when the war was on. The people that formerly had been migrant workers and had come from Oklahoma and Arkansas and back there to pick now went to work, either went in the service or they went to work in the shipyards and the airplane factories and industry where they could make a lot more money than they did in the fields. And so it was really a good thing to bring the Mexican people that wanted to help work in the harvest. And there was some pretty rigid things set up. The housing had to be right, and they tried to get the proper food. But and as I said earlier, there were people that they'd have been no damn good anyway, regardless. And so Dick Penny, who was a nephew of J.C. Penny, the big J.C. Penny, lived in our county, and he managed the J.C. Penny in Modesto, which was a large. And we were having coffee one day, and he was telling me about when it came time for the braceros to go home, they would come into Penny's and they would buy bolts of cloth to take back with them. And I know, because of being in the post office, there'd be long lines of farm workers, mostly braceros, sending money back home. And I also became acquainted with some young fellas out at a farm. They'd been at the same farm for 3 years, and I knew the farmer really well. And these were guys that were braceros during the harvest time, but they were college students in Mexico, and we would like for our own kids to have a summer job so that they can buy clothes, their own clothes, or when they go back to school, to college. I was happy when my kids had summer jobs when they went to college, and all five of my kids are college graduates and beyond, the bachelor's degree. But the Bracero program afforded just a lot of young men, and I don't know whether it's women, but that afforded young men an opportunity to come and work in the fields and make the money that would provide their college tuition and their keep till the next season. And along with that, there's another thing about work ethic. A great deal of the pay was on what they call piecework, so that you the more you picked, the more money you got. And I knew several examples where there'd be one person might pick one box, These were usually alcoholics. They'd pick one box so they could buy their booze for the day. But at the same time they were picking one box, there were people picking 30 boxes in a day. And we had an interesting experience. I'd been up in Oregon, where Oregon had a really a great deal going, where they used high school kids to pick the berries and the beans. And then somebody decided that this was stunting their kids' growth or something, and it was not healthy, and so they quit it. But it was really a great deal, and the kids enjoyed it. But so I took this idea back to California, and I talked about it at a Farm Bureau meeting. And so then...
In what year?
Oh, this would have been 70... 79 maybe, 78, 79. And so when they got it started, they picked these select kids that all had a B plus or better, would be the only kids that they would take out to the field. Well, in the same field were kids that came in and were hired that their big ambition was to buy their own bicycle, and they just worked circles around these other kids who didn't really have an incentive. There's one kid that I knew very well. He was a neighbor of ours, and he picked whatever the rest of them picked. If the rest of the kids picked five, he would have his five. If they picked 10, he'd pick 10, but he never really wanted to go beyond. He didn't want to be a show off and pick more than the rest of them. But there were some other notes I wanted to make about.
Can I ask you a question? When
sure.
Did you buy your farm? I mean your vineyard.
When? What year? That was in. About 57, 58.
And did you notice a difference in California between farm labor systems and right before the war, right before you left, and then when you returned to California in the 1950s? In terms of workers?
As a kid, I wasn't involved in any farm work whatsoever, but I've seen the big change in California has been in crops that they've grown grow. Interesting. I attended a lecture at the University of California just for the farm advisors. And Dr. Winkler, who was Mr. Grape, he was known the world over as the grape authority. And this would have been about 1980 or so. And he said, well, it just looks to me that all of the grapes that can be planted in California have been planted. He said, that's the only areas that are suitable for grapes. And... So he's turning over in his grave now, because since then they have planted probably 100,000 more acres in areas where they never dreamed that they would grow grapes. And not only that, but they've moved into Oregon and have planted thousands and thousands of acres of grapes in Oregon and in Washington State. And every state in the Union now has commercial vineyards. And at the time, they said, well, that's it. There's no more room available to grow good wine grapes. And, of course, Oregon is growing, is recognized as having the best Pinot Noir of anybody in the world. And they just grow good grapes here. The other thing was almonds. And I can't call her name, the people that were so big in Hawaii. At any rate, they called me the people that owned most of Hawaii, Dole. Dole called me and asked me if I would meet with them. They wanted to, the sugarcane industry was moving out of, and pineapple industry was moving out of Hawaii, and they wanted to expand into other agricultural things. Now they're one of the biggest in the world. But they asked me, what about grapes? And I said, no, grapes are overdone. Well, what about almonds? I said, well, boy, it just looks like they planted way too many almonds. And so they just didn't, I couldn't recommend anything. Yet, it shows, you know, you think you know everything. Since that time, they probably planted, I'm guessing, 500,000 additional acres of almonds. Almonds everywhere. And I know one guy that is farming 4,000 acres, one man farming 4,000 acres of almonds, and processes 10 million pounds for the almond industry. They send the almonds there, and he's got the big processing plants that hauls them and cleans them. I got a call from a banker in Chicago. Apparently he'd gone down there. I belonged to Alpha Gamma Rho fraternity, which is an agricultural fraternity, and he saw that I was an Alpha Gamma Rho and that I lived in, that I was a farm advisor. So he called me from Chicago, and he had a client that wanted to invest. And so this guy had millions to invest, and they, I sat down with him, and we talked about the different things that he wanted to invest in California. And he was from Algeria. No, he wasn't. He was from Singapore, and he was having trouble with a communist regime, and he wanted to take his money out of there and invest it in California. Well, finally he said, well, what would you do if you had $60 million? And I said, well, I'd buy a jet, and I'd buy a big limousine. And he said, no, not that. He said, what would you do with farming? It's difficult to tell people how to spend their money in farming, and especially the way farming has gone. Things have changed so drastically. One of the things that has not changed is the fact that most of the farm crops still have to be picked by hand, and even the tomatoes picked by machine require a lot of labor. And so there are people, including Senator Feinstein from California, who are, because of her clientele, the people who put her in office, she is pushing for a new farm worker program, and I think it's essential. We hear so much about the people coming from all over South America and Central America to work here, and as illegals, but most of them, only a very small percentage of them end up in farming. They go into all these other things, meat packing, lumber, the building industry, just all sorts of things, but they don't end up in agriculture. Agriculture is in the same desperate straits as far as farm help that it was when I was involved in agriculture. And here in Washington and in Oregon last year, tons and tons of pears and berries because there were no farm workers available to pick them. And It's a terrible thing. I've had men call me, and you could tell they were crying. They said, "Paul, what can I do? I'm ready to pick, and I can't find anybody." And I said, I just can't help you. Jones down the road is about to finish up. Why don't you call over there and see where his pickers are going next?" And it's a desperate thing. And in California, the last few years they've continued to lose crop because there's no pickers. And I know I was in. Even though it wasn't in my realm, I felt strongly about it, and I was in correspondence with the Mexican consulate when they were about to do away with the original Bracero program, and the Mexican consulate was very much in favor of the Bracero program, because it was the second largest dollar income, only next to tourism. And from my standpoint, my knowledge of agriculture, I'd like to see a new worker program developed, and forgetting the crap that came out in Harvest of Shame. The people that came here, it was to their advantage. They had nothing in Mexico or Salvador or wherever they came from, and they were able to work and make enough money to support their families, and then go home and live well for the rest of the year, and then next year come back. And so
how did you start the correspondence with the Mexican consulate?
I just wrote to them directly, and
what compelled you to write to them?
What
compelled you to write to them?
The fact that they were doing away with the Bracero program, and I saw the need for farm workers. I was intimately involved in it, and on my own farm. I had a good contractor, and we didn't ask any questions about where the people came from. But in addition to those people that were here illegally, the Bracero program was still a necessity. And we hear so much about the millions of people that are here illegal, but again, they don't go into agriculture, and we are losing. So the same thing that compelled me to go over to the St. Mary's University and debate the whether grapes should be served on the campus or not compelled me to contact the Mexican consulate, and they were quick to answer my letter and encouraged me to do everything that I could do, and I was involved enough in it that one day when I came into my office and there was two strangers in there, and the receptionist came down and says, "I don't know who those guys are. They just barged into your office." Well, it was two senators had come out for Senate for the farm labor hearings. And they had heard from my congressman that I kept involved and knew what was going on. So it was Senator Adlai Stevenson Jr. and Senator, the other one was a junior also, but they wanted me to come to testify at the farm labor hearings about what was going on, and I told him I enjoyed talking to him but I didn't want to get involved because I had five children, and I said this union thing has a bunch of goons out there, and I said I don't want to. I'm brave, but I'm not that brave, Yeah, it was a terrible thing. I knew Ernest and Giulio Gallo personally, and the Gallo Winery was picked on because it was a name, but the Gallos had farm labor housing, and they had stuff housing for their year-round farmers in addition to the Bracero program, and they had the best housing and paid the best wages and even had medical care for their farm workers, which was unique in that day. And yet, because they were a name, they were picked on by Cesar Chavez. I've never met Cesar Chavez. I've seen him walking down the marching on one of his marches, but I understand that he was a kind person, but he attracted some guys that were not really nice people, and I knew the security people at Gallo's, and they told me, and there's no reason for them to lie, that Gallo's replaced thousands of tires that of the farm workers that would not join the union, and they'd go in there and ice pick their tires, and Gallo's had this one tire company practically full time would go, and they would lift up the car and replace all four tires rather than repair them, and those stories. You never hear those stories. They don't hit the newspaper.
What was the relationship like between the union activists and the braceros?
The civilian people?
The civilian people that were active in forming a union and the braceros on these farms.
Well, they preferred braceros. Because when the crops were picked, the braceros would return home, and so there was no feeling that they had to care for them or anything. The housing was empty during the winter, and I found that the farmers made good friends with a lot of the farmers spoke Spanish, and they made good friends of the people. And I know out at the Berry Hill farm and at the Superior Ranch, there was two ranches that I worked closely with when it was time for the harvest was over. They'd put on what they called a fiesta, and they would have a big barbecue. That was the first time I ever ate goat meat, and after I had a couple of brandies, I said okay, and so they fixed me up a burrito with goat meat, and I thought it was pretty good, but there was. You know, other than those examples that I told you about the bad guys feeding people bologna sandwiches without any mayonnaise or lettuce, they put the bread out there in slices of bologna. I'd have walked off of the job too. And this other guy that had them in our county that after the they'd finished picking his grapes, and he threatened to get, he says, better get out of here or I'll call the Border Patrol. I keep forcing myself not to say the kind of words that I would ordinarily say. My son knows that I know those words. This is my son right here. This is Maria. I want to go over this and Maria and Rico.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
In Modesto, when all of this childish activism was happening?
The big thing was the change in the churches. because all of the churches took up the Cesar Chavez's side, that the farm workers were being abused, and in my case, our whole family we were Methodists, and we were, the kids went to Sunday school. My wife taught. I was on a commission on missions and a commission on education, and within our church. But when they started this Cesar Chavez stuff, I quit along with. The church was empty, and no farmers would go to church, and even the Catholics, and you know, are you Catholic? Probably are. And the Catholic farmers, where it was so important for them to go to Mass, they just had a terrible burden on themselves, because they knew that this program, the way that was, they were trying to force the farm workers into the union, and it was wrong. And even at that time, he was I knew him as Mahoney, was a reverend, and now I think he's a Cardinal Mahoney, and he was so liberal. And of course, Bobby Kennedy came out to California and fasted with Cesar Chavez, and there was a real enmity between the believers and non-believers, and I had a good friend that was a newborn Christian, and he was after me. Get back in the church. Fight them from within the church. Don't fight them from outside the church. And I said, no. I said, when they start all this stuff in church, instead of preaching, getting into these politics of labor, it isn't right as far as I was concerned. And so. I remember being in a restaurant, and I told the proprietor, I knew him, and I said, you don't care what happens to farmers. And boy, he really bristled. He said, the hell I don't. He says when the farmers are having problems, he said, I don't have anybody eating here. And so it was a funny thing, you know, the power of television, and when they had that Harvest of Shame and showed it was worse than concentration camps, you know, and showed the people being locked in at nighttime. What a bunch of hogwash! They were happy people. They were happy to have a job, and they were. They worked. They were industrious. I wouldn't do farm work, man. When you see the guys come out of the vineyard, they start early in the morning when the vines still have dew all over them, and when they're picking the grapes, they're going like this inside, and they're sopping wet, and they've got grape juice all over them. The vines, as the day wears on, and the vines are dusty and when they walk out of the field after their day is done, they're filthy. I mean, I wouldn't do it. I picked tomatoes one day when I was in the Navy at receiving station, and the call went out. We need tomato pickers, and I went over and I picked tomatoes for a little while. I didn't like it, and stoop labor, that I still know that's one of the toughest things, old age, but I hate to stoop over. And but you see these guys that work at it, watching them harvest onions, and Boy, they're just right down there, and it's so dirty, and they're picking up these bags of onions and dumping them, and it's not work that I would want to do. But my kids had a first hand choice. He was my number one pruner, and they pruned the vineyard, and then the co-op that I belong to, Allied Grape Growers, they joined the union, and we were told that we could not hire our own children on the farm, which that was the reason we moved on to the farm. And they said no, but I had the kids out there pruning, and nobody ever there was not enough farm workers to go around anyway.
Why did they decide to work with the union, the Allied Grape Growers?
It was a case of them being forced into it. They held back a large number of pickers, and also the Allied Grape Growers. The number of the people were strong in the Catholic Church, and they joined. I think that was the important reason that they went into it. But how
long did it take them to get convinced to be part of the union? Was it years?
Oh yeah, it didn't happen. It didn't happen overnight. Because so many of the individual growers fought it, but Allied Grape Growers is going through a big change. They were at that time. Well, when we pulled out our vineyard, the price offered to me was not sufficient to pay for the pruning, and so the grapes were just hanging there, and I was desperate to find a home for the grapes. Julio Gallo called me and said, "I understand you haven't sold your grapes." And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I'll take them." I said, "No, they should have been picked 3 or 4 days ago, and I don't need your charity." So we called in a bulldozer and we pulled out the vines. The point I'm trying to make is that Allied was in a real pinch because the price of grapes was so low, and they were kind of forced into joining the union, but at the same time there was a large winery owned by the Jesuits that also joined the union, and the priest who was in charge of their vineyards in our county, he and I became good buddies. We would taste wine together, and he was more like a guy than being a priest. He just was really a regular guy, and not being Catholic, I kind of questioned calling him father, you know, because he wasn't my father, but he was a nice guy, and after they went in the union, he told me, he said that his happiest times were when he would come down and work in the vineyard and hear the birds singing and everything. And he says, and now, he says, the union has just taken my happiness away from me. And then that particular vineyard, in order to, they thought they weren't getting paid enough. They were getting paid piecework, and they had a slowdown. And so instead of taking 2 minutes to prune a vine, they were taking 5 or 6 minutes. Cut. I was out there, and And so the price of pruning a vine went from, like, I think they're paying him 16 cents a vine, went to 35 or 40 cents, and they just couldn't compete. That they sold the vineyard and the Jesuit. Do you remember the name of that winery the Jesuits had? But it just ended, huh?
Was it in Escalon?
No, it was over on the coast, over near Salinas. Let's see if I get them.
How long did you own your vineyard?
How my bookkeeper? How long did we own the vineyard?
Oh, from 19. Well, we moved in 1967. We moved out in 1990. But we didn't have the vineyard for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I don't know what year you pulled it. What year you went on sabbatical?
1979.
Well, you pulled it about 1982, I think.
Yeah. I've already talked about the fact that the price of the grapes was such that
we couldn't
pick it even.
And then after that, you moved up to Oregon?
No. When I retired and sold the farm and we moved back to New Mexico where
I wish I was still.
Yeah, moved back to New Mexico because my wife's mother lived there and she was in ill health, and so we moved back there
and we had met there
and had good friends at the college and then I got really sick with the shingles, a dumb thing, and the kids laid the law down to us that we had to be closer to them because they'd have to fly into El Paso and then drive 80 miles to where we lived. And so Philip lived here in Salem, and we have a daughter that lives in Washington State. And then the other three children are in the Bay Area of California, near Oakland, and so we.
I was the only one that didn't lay down the law, so he moved close to me.
He was the lucky one.
Yeah. So we moved to Oregon, I haven't been active in farming since being here. We had a farm in New Mexico, but it was alfalfa. It didn't require any labor. But I worked with a number of grape growers, having been a specialist in California, and New Mexico was kind of backward, but getting into the
just starting
in the grapes, and so I was able to help a number of the growers at no charge. I wouldn't do any consulting there.
Do you remember any more details about your time in Modesto? And in particular, I'm interested in that period where Cesar Chavez was organizing in that area. Do you remember any more details about your experiences with the union?
Well, I worked very closely with one of the organizers and one of the lieutenants in that area, and he had a boysenberry farm, and at that time there was so much I guess you call it liberal stuff. And this guy, I can't even think of his name, but he was practically given this orchard, or they called them patches, this boysenberry field. It was on California-owned property where they had a poultry research station, and they took out everything. And the idea was it was almost like an ejido. The land was given to this guy, and he was going to furnish work for the poor farm workers around there. And the guy was a crook. He cheated everybody. He took off, and so then he came to me with an idea that he was going to grow hydroponic tomatoes, and this was going to put a lot of farm workers to work. And I said, you know, hydroponic tomatoes in Modesto is not economic. It won't work. There's too many tomatoes growing in the ground that taste just as good. And I said, the only place where hydroponic tomatoes has been successful is in some islands where they can't grow anything. And I said it provides for those people that live there. So he went before a congressional thing and said that he went to the farm advisor's office and tried to get help in growing hydroponic tomatoes, and was told, well, you ought to go to the Ascension Islands. Well, that isn't what I told him at all. I told him that it was not practical. So I get a call from the congressman saying, what's his deal here? You turning down these guys? And I said, you know, that I knew the congressman well. And I said, hey, you know that I'm not going to tell anybody that. I said, I gave him as much help as I could and told him that the only place that was practical was at the Ascension Islands. So there was a lot of hard feelings. I know that, as I told you earlier, that the lot of the farmers left their churches, and people who were really strong in the church, they quit tithing giving to the church, because they said, hey, you're working against us, why should we support you? And it was a tough thing. It was a thing you didn't discuss with people who lived in town, because they read only in the newspapers what was going on. And of course, with the support from the Catholic Church and a very liberal newspaper, it was hard to tell people that, hey, the farmers have a desperate need for farm workers, and they don't abuse the farm workers. And the story I told you earlier about the fact that they come back year after year. If somebody hurts you, you don't go back a second time. If you burn your hand on the stove, you don't go back and say, hey, what happened? Touch it again. And I knew a farm during the Bracero program where the same workers would be there year after year. Those young college students I told you about. So the organizing that went on, you know, it started down in Selma and Tulare County, and moved up into our county, and moved all the way up north to Asti, the vineyards that were owned by Allied Grape Growers.
Started in Salinas.
And started in, and then over in Salinas with the lettuce workers. And the lettuce workers are among the highest paid farm workers, because it's piecework. And if you can see these people, you can't even see their hands. They're moving so fast. I made a call out to Modesto had a really thriving strawberry plant industry. They supplied the plants to practically all of California from this one place up there, and the they would after digging the plants and they were laying there and they would bundle them. I guess it'd be like 100 in a bundle. And you could not believe those people that were packing. Their hands moved so fast that you couldn't see them. And the owners pointing out there was piecework, pointing out the people that were so fast. They were back in those days. I guess probably $6 an hour was good pay, and there were people making $10 and $15 at piecework. I mean, you had the whole picture from those that picked with the one box so they could buy their bottle of booze to the guy that was picking 30 boxes. But there were times when, as I told you, in the Boysenberries, when the pickers made more money than the farmer did. And I don't think the economics are the same way now. I think farmers for most of their crops are getting a good price. But there's always a spread between what you pay in the store and what the farmer gets. It's sometimes it's unconscionable with the apples. There was one store here that was selling apples for $2.50 a pound. What does that come to a ton? $2.50 a pound is going to be over $4,000 a ton. And I know that the farmer was only making maybe $300 a ton. But the broker in between has a fixed rate. And then the handler has a fixed rate, and the store wants to make a profit, and the farmer may not be hardly making enough. If Philip teaches it, and he can tell you that this.
Some part of the price is set globally, where the expenses are all local.
So you asked about the feelings. I know what my personal feelings were, but I had friends that were just as bitter as I was. I was bitter because of my own farm, but also bitter because I could see what was going on, and these farmers were my friends, and when somebody calls you with the tears in their voice and said, "What am I going to do? I don't have any pickers, and my fruit is dropping on the ground." There was one deal that involved ladders, and so the farmers were all taking their ladders to wherever it needed to be picked. The farmers would furnish the ladders so that they could get the crops picked. They set up organizations. The biggest organization was the one that was called the Nisei, was down in more into the Central Valley by second generation Japanese, and they had a big organization to fund the Bracero program and to protect the program. In Modesto, they had a program called the Grower Relations program, this was after the Bracero program had quit, and I told you they would go into Arkansas and New Mexico and Oklahoma and proselytize, bring people to California to work. They would assure them that when they got there, there would be work. And sometimes this took some doing to make sure that the workers were there when the when the crop had to be picked. There are times like this year here in Oregon where the where almost everything is 3 weeks to a month late, and you have the farm workers come in to pick, and it's not ready, and so that's dead time for them. They're paying their expenses of living and don't and aren't able to pick. But I think that they still have some quasi organizations that work towards making sure that the pickers and the farmers get together. The Farm Bureau was always ineffective at it. They didn't see this as their job. The Farm Bureau tried to protect the Bracero program, but they lost their voice. You know, farmers are a minority. I don't know.
Poorly organized.
Huh?
Poorly organized.
Yeah.
Right.
Back in, you know the statistics better than I do, but back in early 1900s, one farmer fed himself and 25 families. And the mid-1900s, one farmer fed himself and 100 other families. Now one farmer feeds himself and maybe 1,000 or 2,000 families. And of course, there's a right to, and looking at it today, there's this big movement for bought to buy local, and a lot of people try to do that, but Oregon doesn't grow citrus and avocados and the spices, and so you can only do a certain amount local, and the corn is only available for a short period of time in Oregon when we can get corn out of Mexico or from California, from Texas. But the union now is still effective. The farm workers union is still effective only in certain things. The melon packagers have a strong union, and the melon packers make as much money as a college professor. They really have it down good, and it's a close knit. You have to know how to get into it, and the lettuce pickers have a union, and it's pretty close knit too, and you have to be born into it almost. So I think I've covered all my notes, but there were some people that I'm hoping that you can contact or have your contacts contact.
Let me stop the tape. Thank you very much.